From the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois, I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, live from the U of I tent. We are at the corner of 3rd Street and West Avenue. If you want to come and visit us, please do so tomorrow. It's a great day. You know what? It's really hot out, but our tent's not terribly bad. We're on the west end of the Farm Progress Show site. That means that we get the westerly wind, and it does blow through. Yesterday was not oppressive. Today, a little worse. Tomorrow probably will be a whole lot better, and the crowd should be pretty light tomorrow. So come out and see us. That's tomorrow. We'll be up on stage with Orion Samuelson, the legendary farm broadcaster from WGN, at 10:30 a.m., and then I'm back up here at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Let's talk with Mike Gray. He's an extension entomologist at the University of Illinois. Has an update on a really important topic for farmers, BT corn. In particular, one of the hybrids that was first released, one of the genetic modifications. You've been doing some research with it. This is the Yield Guard, the first version of it, and it has developed a big problem with some insects, and things keep moving along, and you've got some new research or some new updates out of Kankakee area.
Well, that's right, Todd. On Monday of this week, Joe Spencer, an entomology colleague of mine, both of us traveled up into Livingston County, Kankakee County, and unfortunately ran into some very severe corn rootworm damage. What made this story, I think, unique is the fact that this was severe corn rootworm damage on rotated corn. All right, now we know we have a rotation-resistant western corn rootworm in this state, and that's been the case for about a decade and a half. But what made this very unique was the severity of damage, the intense root feeding, the lodging. Again, rotated corn ground and BT had been used in those fields. So we've had a lot of reports, not only in this state, but in some other Corn Belt states, that at least in continuous corn production systems, some BT hybrids, those that express the Cry3BB1 protein, the Yield Guard rootworm protein, we're having some issues. This is a first in that we're now talking about rotated corn. So we have an insect that is rotation resistant, and it looks very suspicious that it, who knows, we still have tests to complete, but could be resistant to that one BT protein as well. And these were commonly the VT triple pro, you know, the single traded hybrids.
Mike Gray, of course, is an extension entomologist at the University of Illinois. You can find more from him on the Bulletin website. The website address is bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu. It's easier to search Google for Bulletin and comma illinois.edu. I'm Todd Gleason. Okay, Mike, let's continue on with our conversation just a bit, because once this insect has managed to adapt again, to rotation, it becomes a bigger problem for farmers in many areas. Now they've got an insect that they have to worry about again, not only in continuous corn. That gets rid of one possibility where they could rotate away from it and keep it in check. Do they go back to insecticides? Can they go to the other types of genetic modifications for BT? Do they need to use both? What are your recommendations?
Well, my recommendations, particularly in areas where we're seeing this very significant problem, as growers make decisions for 2014 regarding seed choice, I think definitely consider the use of a pyramided BT hybrid, one that expresses more than a single Cry protein. If you go down that road, a soil insecticide should not be needed with those pyramided BT hybrids. On the other hand, if you decide to go with a single traded BT hybrid, particularly one that has shown some, has had some performance issues, then a soil insecticide on top of that single traded BT hybrid makes sense. And then one other consideration, too. Again, we can still go with some non-BT hybrids and use of soil insecticides on those. So there are some options, but unfortunately, there aren't that many arrows left in the rootworm quiver, if you will.
The western corn rootworm, it is an insect to be not treated lightly then.
Well, that's right. It's the number one most economically important insect pest of corn in the world. So.
Thanks so much. Mike Gray is an extension entomologist at the University of Illinois. He joins us on the closing market report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. We are coming to you live from the Farm Progress Show. The record date is August, what day is it? The 28th. That's right, because yesterday was my 25th anniversary. And I forgot to mention that to my wife, Claire Ann. We had a great time last night. Went to Baron Stoop in Gibson City. It was a fantastic evening. She said to me, it's not new that you're gone for your anniversary. It's been state fairs or Farm Progress Show. Well, since we got married in 1988. One other thing about our 1988 marriage, of course, drought year, but it rained while we were in the midst of our wedding ceremony. I think that was a really good note to start our wedding ceremony on, and it seems to have worked, at least for the first 25 years. The stage with us now is Jackie Vick. She's from Stuart Peterson from Champaign County. Jackie, thank you so much for coming out to the show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, producers have a lot of worries on their minds at this point. Among them are what happens with the corn crop in this heat, and more importantly, what do they do with the crop that they've already sold and keeps getting a larger percentage of that they may very well harvest?
Well, it's really tough. I mean, this is probably the worst possible thing we could have had, Todd, because of the fact that we had such a lazy rooted crop with all the moisture we had in the spring. And, you know, what do you do if it keeps getting bigger? Well, you know, your only choice is basically is at some point in time to try and re-own and hold back on sales right now. The big thing, I think, when you look at corn, though, is, you know, corn has a tremendous amount of carryout. And We may find that next week, if we don't get any rain at all, we'll rally again. But that could possibly be the end of the rally for the moment, and then we can find ourselves going lower on corn and then coming back in the fall when we actually start to harvest.
What do you think the possibility? I think this is a funny time, because at this point, it's really tough to say whether USDA, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, and I know you will, that the USDA's 154.2 bushel the average acre is right or wrong, and in which direction it might be right or wrong, because Iowa, which was late and remains late, by the numbers, has a really big crop, and they got a rainfall last week.
Well, they did get a rainfall last week, but they're still number one in the top five driest states in the production area. So how much did that rainfall do, and how much was it? They had a 2-inch, one little tiny spot. That's not the whole state. And so,
I heard about the spot, though.
I'm sure you did. I think from the USDA perspective, I was surprised to see them drop it the way they did on this last report. I expect to see them drop it again. You know, the big uphill climb we have is to try and overcome how much carryout we have, primarily because USDA added so much demand to be able to keep us at a carryout that was below 2 billion bushels.
Oh, so your thought process here is, even if we get a smaller crop, that USDA is overbooked how much we can actually consume.
Well, we know that they made about a 1.5 billion bushel adjustment. And so, you know, when you look at that, even when you look at exports, we know the higher the corn price goes, the tougher it is for us to sell corn. We know in these type of circumstances, when you're seeing premature denting going on, you're going to get light test weight corn. Again, another hurdle that the export market has to get over. And so, you know, it's just a situation. They have us up 550 million bushels on corn exports. We're up 250 million bushels on ethanol exports. You know, that probably, or ethanol usage, it's one of those situations where when you look at the ethanol market, we were exporting so much to Brazil the last couple of years. That's only because sugar prices were so high, they could afford to sell sugar and not make ethanol. Well, they're back making ethanol again. So I think we're going to have a real scratch to try and get ourselves even to consume the extra 250 million bushels for the ethanol for this year. So I don't want to be a damp towel on a hot day. Well, maybe I do. But
actually, that's not a bad idea.
That's actually not a bad thing. But you know, it's really hard not to be extremely bullish when you're experiencing this and you're seeing your crop go down in yield all of the time. But the reality is, you know, you can lose 800 million bushels and still be at a billion bushel carryout without changing the demand. And so I just think that farmers have to be aware of that. If we get a rally in this market, you haven't made sales, you need to get puts in place, you need to do something to protect yourself, because the circumstance with beans is entirely different. That bean situation is, they don't have any carryout, and we have horrible weather for beans. So I'm not as concerned about that side of it, but when it comes to the corn can only go so far, and then the selling will come back in.
Jackie, thank you so much. Give Jackie a nice round of applause. Jackie Bakes is with Stuart Peterson. She joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Wednesday, and today from the Farm Progress Show. Don Olson joins us now. He's with Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Don, thank you so much for taking the time. I heard some land sales recently that were still pretty high. I think Piatt County, what, at 12,650 or 12,620 or something along those lines in the last couple of weeks. What's your view of the price of land over the next 6 months?
Well, we've seen land escalate from 8 to 10 to 12 to 14 thousand is what we're seeing the higher producing land selling for now. It seems to be going into pretty strong hands, and anyone who is in the market to buy and has cash, and there's a farm in the neighborhood, if there's two bidders, they bid it up. So I'm not sure where the actual value of land is. I know what sale prices have been doing.
The value is always the sale price, but you're convinced that it's not just moved by locality.
Location.
All right.
Also, interest rates and expected future farm income is going to be part of the formula to determine what the price does.
Producers are concerned, I know, about interest rates and whether they will move higher. What are your thoughts?
They already have moved higher on the longer end of the yield curve. The short end is still very low. And we're being told to expect continued climbing on the longer end of the curve.
And finally, just a bit about Farm Credit Services, the value it offers to producers, and what kind of products you have.
Well, Farm Credit Services is a nationwide network of cooperative lenders. We serve the southern 60 counties in Illinois. Cooperatively owned, our board of directors are farmers, and they keep us grounded in serving the needs of farmers. So we offer crop insurance and loans. We have about $3.4 billion of loans outstanding. About 60% of that is real estate financing, and we covered 1.2 million acres with crop insurance last year.
Thank you so much, Don. Don Olson is with Farm Credit Services of Illinois. He's located, are you in the Mahomet office, is that right? He's in Mahomet, Illinois, and they serve us the southern half of the state. Well, on hand with us to continue our conversation about economics is Gary Schnittke. I talk with Gary all the time there in Mumford Hall. And Gary, you just penned an article about something that producers in the southern half of the state really will be interested in. They tell me once in a while that I do not talk about this topic often enough. Wheat, wheat, wheat. And you looked at, well, there we go. I knew there was some, yeah, there they are. I knew there were some folks that would be happy to hear about that. And you looked at whether wheat pays or not and when it does. Tell me about the survey.
Yeah, what we did was we used FBFM data to look at those farms in southern Illinois that raised wheat and those that didn't raise wheat and which had the higher profits over 2006 through 2012. What we basically found is those farms that raised wheat had about the same profitability as those that didn't raise wheat. Double crop on those farms aided in increasing the profitability of wheat, and roughly farms with wheat acres between 10 and 20% were the most profitable of the wheat farms. But overall, wheat was a competitive crop and worked well on those operations.
But more competitive when you put soybeans behind it.
That's absolutely right. And wheat, double crop, soybeans, there was a big difference between those farms that did and did not do wheat, double crop. Some of that, though, also some farms in some years won't do double crop because the option isn't available, but we did find a big difference.
Do I recall correctly that this is kind of funny, but that the lower percentage of wheat that you had on the farm plus the double crop soybeans, the higher the income was?
Yeah, well,
or is?
What we found is that wheat, once we got above 25% of the acres, the profitability actually went down a bit. And we had, well, What caused that's a good question. A lot of that may be due to weather and timing and those sorts of issues. But that's what we did find. Over 25%, it began going down.
Okay, thanks so much, Gary. Gary Schnutke is with the University of Illinois. He's part of the Farm Doc team. You can find him online at farmdoc.illinois.edu. Let's talk more about commodity markets. Greg Wagner here is here. He's with GWX out of Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Greg. How are you this afternoon?
Hi, Todd. It's a pleasure.
No, well, tell me about your view of the marketplace and what Chicago's been thinking over this last couple of weeks.
I don't know. I think Chicago kind of like reacts and it doesn't think. There's not much thought in basically computers. I don't know if they have that. It's a price action. The bottom line, looking at what we've developed and you've looking at markets and where we've been, where we are today, it's not unprecedented. It's like any market. We're reliving history. A lot of people are saying this is 1995, all revisited. And you're looking at 1995. 95 was different, okay, and corn ended up at 550. We had a contra-seasonal rally in corn. Corn got coasted in a lot of areas. Soybeans, a different story. Again, I can make an argument we get soybeans 1550 perhaps. We traded up to $14. The corn's going to have a struggle. And, you know, people continue to address, and we have to address what our yields are going to be, what our production is going to be. But ultimately, in the case of corn, you could cut enough from the demand side of the equation, you're going to still end up with a 1.5 billion bushel carryout and sub $5 corn, 450 corn.
Greg Wagner, of course, is with GWX. He's in Chicago, Illinois. A couple of folks on the stage with us to talk about the cash grain market, Matt Bennett from TGM and Brian Stark from the Andersons. I want to ask both of you these questions. Are you going to pass this off all the way? Because he knows what's coming. Yeah. So I want to know, because farmers are asking this question, hey, you said we ought to lock basis in. We're not sure that that's the right thing to do, but we're not sure what to do about basis at this point. So what's your answer to their question?
I think it depends on timing, Todd. I think the biggest thing, if you tell me I'm going to have a normal fall and I'm going to harvest the bulk of my crop in the middle of October, then I'm going to tell you that you probably should lock basis in today. We've got a big crop. While it not may be a bin buster we once thought, the 14 billion bushel, it's plenty, as a lot of people have alluded to early, given our reduced demand expectations. So at some point, space is going to become an issue. What I've told guys is that what you really need to do this year more than anything is really scout your fields and know what you got. Because if you tell me you've got 100,000 and I've got 80,000 space, the normal pattern of a producer is he's going to fill his space first and bring his overflow to town. And what I'm going to tell you guys is the best thing to do as we transition a, not a 12-month crop year demand cycle, but we're stretching into a 13-month cycle, you need to take that extra 20,000 bushels and move that to town first.
I couldn't agree more with what Brian has to say. I will tell you that whenever you look at the way this crop is, obviously there's a lot of wild basis levels that are getting thrown around right now. I'm sure that you've heard about them, and I know that they're not all posted, and I don't want to, I don't want to sit here and say that different people get different deals, but I do know this: if a person is really wanting to get a good basis level on some early corn, all they need to do is ask their elevator owner, because there's a very good chance that he's going to have a better deal for you than what you envision. And so, if you can get maybe a $2 over basis and a penny a point drying or half drying, why in the world wouldn't you go out and pick wet corn? I know we don't all like doing it, but would you rather pick wet corn at $6 or corn that's not wet at $4.50?
Matt Bennett, of course, is with TGM. He's out of Windsor, Illinois. And Greg Wagner is with us from GWX, along with Brian Stark from the Andersons. On stage with us as well is Paul Taylor. He's the president of the Illinois Corn Growers Association out of Esmond, Illinois. You're up in the northern part of the state. Tell us where you are and how the corn crop looks.
Well, we're up about 30 miles south of the Wisconsin border and right in the center of the state. We're about an hour west of O'Hare Field. We've had some decent rains. We had 2.3 last week and an inch the week before, so we're still been mowing lawns all summer.
Some of the topics that we don't talk about maybe often enough on the radio station is the farm bill, because we don't have people all the time with us to do that. But you cover that all the time, and we're working without a net at the moment. We have an extension, but not for very much longer, and really the farm bill needs to be done soon.
Absolutely. We know that that's an important safety net. Our grower members have told us through 2012 how important crop insurance is. That's going to go on. But I think for long-term planning, we need to know where this is going. For folks that have been following it, we've had a version come out of the Senate, come out of the House. They're different. The SNAP, the nutrition program, has been ripped out, separated. We don't have a conference committee yet. There's a lot of unknowns, uncertainties. We really don't want an extension. We don't want a five-year extension. I fear this could go down to the wire. And there's only nine congressional days in September, so they've got a lot of work to do and a lot of other important things to have happen.
How many trips have you made to D.C., and do you feel good or bad about the prospects at the moment?
Well, probably in my agricultural leadership activities, close to 30 times, if not more, to D.C. Last year, I'll have to say, was my low. In just having a sense of what's going on, I felt more encouraged in March when we were out there again in July. I think there's a lot of paralysis going on. There's some folks that just aren't willing to govern. They want to have their statements made politically. And until we can get Congress to lead instead of just make statements and posture, we're going to have trouble getting things done progressively.
Let's talk about WRDA, the Water Resources Development Act. This is the way that the locks and the dams on the upper Illinois and Mississippi rivers could be updated. What's the current prospects for that particular legislation?
Well, that we're pretty excited about. We actually got some WRDA, Water Resources Development, several years ago. We did not get any appropriation. That's a problem. It came through the Senate again this year. Appropriations cannot originate in the Senate, so it has to come out of the House side. We've got some good Illinois folks that are helping with leadership with that. Again, budgetary constraints are a problem. Part of the issue is there's two real problems that we're facing. One is we need more money in the Inland Waterways Trust Fund, and that probably is going to have to come from a barge fuel tax increase, which all the parties have agreed to. The second one is Olmsted Lock and Dam down in the Ohio River in southern Illinois. Some of us jokingly say it's a lot like a big hole in the river we're just dumping money into. It's gone over time. It's gone over budget. And until we get that federalized and off the back of the trust fund, we're not going to do it. We talked about exports here. We talked about the crop. We've needed to have a big crop. We think we're coming along with that. But exports are going to have to continue. Ultimately, we need a bigger avenue, venue to send grain down the Mississippi. And in addition to that, about half of the total tonnage that goes south comes back north, whether it's in concrete, there's other industrial products, but also in fertilizer that's used for agriculture and road salt. So this is an important highway in the middle part of the country.
Yeah, it might be important to recall that the excise tax has been in place for a very long time, and I think, and you can correct me, that about half of the cost, or supposedly half of the cost of the updates, are carried by the users.
Absolutely. That's the Inland Waterways Trust Fund. It's money that's put into this fund that comes from barge fuel tax. We're talking about raising it 6 to 9 cents a gallon, so not a lot of huge. It's a relatively substantial percentage-wise, and then the federal government comes in and matches that. The problem, again, is Olmsted's just taking so much money that if we looked ahead, LaGrange isn't scheduled to start a new lock until 2063. Lock 25 isn't scheduled till 2063, it's 64, and those. The point is, we could be two generations out yet. These things are already over 100 years old.
It's just not soon enough.
It's absolutely. We need to have that infrastructure worked on. It's not very sexy, but it's essential.
Thank you so much. Paul Taylor is the president of the Illinois Corn Growers Association. He is from Esmond, Illinois, and joins us here on the Closing Market Report. Remember, you can always find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all of our agricultural programming from the Opening Market Report to the Closing Market Report, everything else in between, and Commodity Week as well. Our special guest this week on Commodity Week is Paul Brueggener, and he is with Farm Futures and Farm Progress Publications, and we'll talk to him maybe a little bit later during the program here on the stage at the University of Illinois tent. We're coming to you live from the Farm Progress Show. The recording date is August the 28th. I'm Todd Gleason, and I was half a second late getting out. If I hadn't had to say my name, I would have been fine. Okay, so the program, I can get rid of that. Paul, did I pronounce your name correctly? Did I get close? Yeah, that's kind of funny. Paul, how do you pronounce it? Brueggener. Oh, I put the R in the wrong place. I'm not the only one. Come on up, Paul. And you can sit up here. I've got a whole bunch of folks that we want to finish off with. So, okay. So Paul is with Farm Futures. And how long, Paul, have you been with Farm Futures? You took Arlen's place, Suderman, right? So a few weeks, and where did you come? Or a few months? Where did you come from before then?
I've been there since November 1st.
Right.
And I was with the University of Nebraska Extension for 12 years at a research center in Scotts Bluff, which is a stone's throw from Wyoming.
Oh, you were way out.
Way out west.
Yeah, did you have much to do with irrigated corn at all in your lifetime in Nebraska?
We're irrigated corn out there on a Bureau of Reclamation project that we're shutting down the water this week.
Tell me about that process, because it fascinates me.
Well, they're government projects. All of our water comes out of the mountains of Colorado and Wyoming and is stored in reservoirs in Wyoming. And then we all fight over the water. It's in the North Platte. In my comments this morning, I mentioned when I was in St. Louis in January, everybody was concerned about water flow on the Mississippi. You couldn't float you couldn't float barges. And they wanted water from us upstream. That's okay, but we kind of need it to irrigate with in the summer. So we weren't sharing. We're upstream from the Missouri, and that water comes down to North Platte. We divert it and irrigate a fairly significant amount of acres up there, and we really didn't care if you could float barges.
Yeah. So when we talk on our radio show, oftentimes we hear there is an allotment for irrigated water that from last year to this year, that allotment changed, that creates some serious problems. Potentially for the corn crop. Did that happen this year in Nebraska?
You know, out where we are, definitely. We work on a kind of a banking program. How much is in those reservoirs, and whatever's there is what we get to use. And that's what I was mentioning. We're turning off the water tomorrow.
Oh. Will that have much of an impact? Are you far enough along to turn it off?
Our corn crop is probably made. Our dry edible bean crop will hurt. And probably our biggest issue is getting sugar beets out of the ground when it gets dry.
Oh, we don't care about sugar beets that much. No, just kidding. Okay, so tell me about your view of the corn and the soybean market. Give me an overview of where you stand.
We thought we had big crops, and things are changing a little bit as we speak. Right now, we're kind of looking at even if the corn crop gets smaller, it's still going to be large. We're not seeing $6 corn unless something else happens besides where we're at today. Soybean crop keeps getting smaller. That's the one, from my perspective, is a little bit more disconcerting. We're a little more concerned about that. We're talking carryouts now back to where we were a year ago. Do we have to do some rationing this fall?
Okay, so given that, do you all agree $6 is not in the offing anywhere for corn at this point? Yes, yes.
I agree.
Everybody agrees, right? $15 in the offing for soybeans?
Potentially,
yeah. Possible. $16? No, 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 no. Mike's looking over his shoulders. Maybe not. We'll have Mike come up here in a bit. Okay. Let's go back to the problem producers are facing here. Well, let's see, where is everybody from? How many from Illinois and or Indiana? Okay. Who's from outside of those two states? Anybody? Ohio, I know. And back here, where are you from? Iowa? Anybody from Iowa? Okay. So most everybody's kind of in the same boat. Oh, yes. Thank you, John. John is from Iowa. Thank you, John Odie. I do appreciate that. We'll have him come up and talk about cattle. That's it. No cattle talk for you this afternoon, John. So for the folks that are, they're all located in this area, relatively speaking, they're going to be dealing probably with a crop that they think is getting smaller. And again, we talked about this earlier on. With Jackie, that they had a percentage sold that keeps getting bigger at this point. What kinds of things can they do, or should they do, or do they need to do anything at all at this point, or do they just depend on their crop insurance? And Paul, why don't we start with you, and we'll work our way around.
We're starting to we made some recommendations to sell some beans this week as that gets a little bit smaller. You know, there's definitely some opportunities in there to make a little money there. We made a recommendation to sell some 14 corn. We're still a little hesitant on corn, but our recommendation's already out there about 45%. So.
Yeah, I think there's one thing in agreement. If you talk and you folks, producers know more than anything, I think a lot of people have been dragging their feet on sales as far as corn and soybeans. So a lot of people are feeling, producers feeling behind the eight ball. And, you know, people are talking $7 corn and so on and so forth. And here we have, you see this rally in soybeans from $1.62 up to $14.09 over less than a three-week period. You have to look at that as a gift, and you have to look at what you're doing as not a casino, it's a business. And you don't have to you don't have to reach for the stars. You have to look where your bottom line is and make your decisions accordingly. Because on any given day, you're going to find more than enough people who say soybeans will go to $15 or $16 or $70. And it's always interesting. You know, when it goes to, when corn's at $6, it's going to $7. When it's at $7, it's going to $8. And you get that. But you have to make decisions yourself. For ourselves, I mean, we've pulled the trigger. I mean, yesterday, look at contract highs. If you look technicals, fundamentals, November soybeans, November 2013 soybeans, life of contract high, 1409 and three quarters, set September 14th of 2012. We traded 1409 and a half day before yesterday actually. So you're looking really at a double top. You're looking at a vertical market, and you're looking at a top that was made over a year ago. That in and of itself is going to give the market pause, and you have an opportunity. You got a line in the sand right there. I can make a case for $15.50 soybeans. Forget about what that is. It's what it means to you. That's where the bottom line. You know, we've got technicals, fundamentals, and we got the psychological of being able to pull the trigger and look at what makes profitable, what makes sense for you, and that's what I think should guide your decisions.
I'd agree with what Greg said. The biggest thing, first off, I would say we don't have a very large book on, so today it feels like the producer, the last couple of years, has gotten burned forward contracting. He's been hesitant as we've adjusted this new regime of price. And I think, obviously, as the crop shrinks, they still have to look at the bottom line. It's not about price. It's about revenue. And I'll give you an example. I had a customer last year who had 100 bushel corn and did a fairly good job marking it at $7. He also had $100 insurance indemnity. That's $800 gross per acre. This year, I know for a fact, he's been in his fields. He's going to have 200 bushel corn. He can sell it for $5. That's $1,000. So the difference between folk being focused on $7 corn versus $5, the revenue situation for him is much better this year. And that's what guys need to focus on for me. And that's what I've tried to press as we have talked to our customers.
I think profitability is the name of the game. These guys are all kind of saying the same thing. I think whenever you look at soybeans, the thing I've been saying a lot of the meetings that I've been doing is that you cannot market a whole lot of soybeans right now if you're dry and you don't know what your beans are going to make. I would certainly be willing to do some risk management if that's what you want to do, but I wouldn't go out there and sell a whole bunch of beans. How many people had to, and you don't have to raise your hands, but how many people had to buy back contracts last year? I mean, that was painful for a lot of people, and we're still at a stage of the game right now, even where we're at. You know, I'm in central Illinois, down here about 45 miles south of here. We had all kinds of moisture up until about a month ago, and now we don't have any kinds of moisture. I mean, it's dry as a bone. And so what do I think my beans are going to make? Hitting it with this kind of drought, I'm going to call it a flash drought, with this timing, I think that it's pretty tough. Now, whenever you're talking about corn, we asked if we thought we were going to get back to $6 corn. We all said no, but I'm pretty sure we'd all be in agreement that you may have a chance to sell $6 cash corn whenever you harvest early, guys, because the basis is so strong for early corn. So don't think because we said there's not going to be any $6 corn that you may not sell any $6 13 corn. It can happen, but there's going to be an enormous disparity between what the basis is on the first load you deliver compared to the 10th load you deliver, potentially. You know, now granted, a lot of you, or the 100th load you deliver, however you want to break it down, but the bottom line is this. Once the pipeline gets full, the basis is not going to be the same. Brian said earlier, basis contracts aren't such a bad idea. We talked before the show. I totally agree with him. If he's bidding 10 under the board, do you think he's going to be doing that when he has a line this fall? Probably Matt, not.
Matt Bennett, of course, is with TGM, and next to him, Greg Wagner with GWX, Paul Bergener. Bergener, thank you. I will get it right eventually, Paul. I will have it spelled somewhere in front of me. Paul Bergener is with Farm Futures, and Brian Stark, of course, is with the Andersons. Jackie Vakes is here. She's with Stuart Peterson. Mike Zuzolo is with us. I'm going to have him come up as well from Global Commodity Analytics, and Jerry Goodell is here. I'm going to have my picture taken pretty soon with all these people. Jerry Goodell is with Rice Dairy, and then John Odie is here from Iowa. We're going to have him talk about the consumption side for just a second and what livestock and prospects for it to continue to consume large amounts of corn in greater amounts in the coming year might be.
The immediate short-term trend in hogs is down. And we've had some really interesting action yesterday and today, in that the midday plant pork cutout yesterday was up $4.01, which was driven largely by a $5 and something rise in bellies. For the day, the plant cutout was off 21 cents. The belly rally did not hold. A more, even more interesting development occurred today. The midday pork cutout was down $4 and I believe 96 cents. I haven't got that number quite ingrained in my mind yet. And the midday bellies were down $15 and nickels. And I blame that entirely on Todd not eating enough bacon and lettuce and tomato sandwiches.
My wife doesn't like that.
The longer term trend in pork production is up as we're generating more expansion. The recent gains that we've seen, or the scares that we've seen in grain prices on this stretch of dry weather, may have reined in that expansion pace a little bit. However, the lion's share of the sows that are going to produce the pork over the next 5 months have already been bred. Those pigs are very close to being on the ground. So we're still going to see pork expansion coming at us. For years, there was a rule of thumb that said, you know, you can depend on love, God, apple pie, death and taxes, and a 3% increase in poultry production. Poultry production also is expanding. Then we go over to beef.
Oh, no, Gary.
The short-term trend in cash-fed cattle prices is higher. The longer-term in beef supply trend is lower. The beef industry will need increasingly higher prices, and that's going to be increasingly difficult to get in the face of rising pork and poultry supplies. Now, Todd mentioned that his anniversary was yesterday and that he took his bride over to that restaurant in Gibson City. And as they were getting done with their salad, she says to him, Todd, you know, we've had 20 really good years.
And you Todd, were there.
And Todd looks at her and he says, well, don't you have your numbers mixed up a little bit? And she says, no. We've had 20 really good years and 3 so-so years and 2 years that were HE double toothpicks.
That might be true.
Exactly.
That very well might be true. That very well might be true. Okay, Jerry Goodell is here from Rice Dairy. He's
Thank
in
you.
Chicago, Illinois. Jerry, I know you've got a lot to say. Which of the two is your favorite market at the moment? Corn, beans, and you could do wheat, gold, if you want.
No. Well, of course, soybeans are always fun and difficult at all the same time. They're a market right now that, you know, the people that I cut the end of the previous panel here talking about the reality of what kind of yields we're going to have on these beans, basically starting from what the Missouri River all the way across Iowa, northern Illinois, half of Indiana here. You know, things have just dramatically changed here in the last 3 weeks. In this area and in Iowa, it already started a month before that. excuse me. Soybean side of the things, we have come to the point where we have a terribly tough transition between our old crop supplies, our new crop supplies. The basis is still reasonably strong. You've mentioned in here if the southern producers are going to take advantage of this stronger basis to move some beans into the thing before the Midwest is going to have a chance to deliver beans here in late in September and October and that. But at the same time, you also have to remember that South America is going to end up taking advantage of these prices. They're already selling their beans and getting their products down there to expand. I anticipate acreage down there to expand at least 5, maybe as much as 7%. And so their 82 or 3 million metric ton crop could be 90 million metric tons next year if that comes along. I think that the marketing opportunities here in soybeans are going to be between now and the first of the year. I think you need to take that into consideration here, what advantages and now and potentially post-harvest situations are going to be here on the soybean side of things. Corn prices are on the low side right now in the futures. Basis is still strong. I'd consider to look at that myself as an opportunity to move any particular supplies that you don't have any storage capabilities for, move those supplies. If you really want to be optimistic or optimistic long-term about corn, you really have to look at it as an option play next spring. Look at where we're at then. This is not the last few years have been a tight supplies. They've been building. We've had opportunities to have storage returns, things like that. I don't know that this is what we're seeing here in this year myself.
Anybody got a question they want to ask? Oh, surely somebody's got a question. Mike Zuzulo. Yep, what's your question? Hi, Jeff. Well, everybody is bearish. Maybe we ought to be buying corn today. Mike Zuzulo, why don't you take that part up? It sounds like it might be in your wheelhouse.
Well, Todd, it's hot today. I think it's part of the reason why we're bearish corn. In fact, it was so hot today, the fire hydrants were chasing the dogs. It was so hot today, they put a fan on the debt ceiling. To get to your question, I think bottom lining it for me, and it picks up on what Jerry was talking about, what's the market put the premium in? Futures market, not cash. What's the futures market taking the premium out of? When you look at the stocks-to-use ratios globally, I think the futures market's forgotten about the global stocks. And if you look at the global stocks-to-use ratios right now, wheat and coarse grains are at or below where they were in 2011. Meanwhile, wheat and corn are trading at 2009, 2010 price levels. Meanwhile, the bean-corn ratio is trading at 2009 price levels. So what I would say from a future standpoint only, because the other panel handled the cash basis perfectly, in my opinion, the futures point would be an undervalue market in the feed grains and an overvalue market in the soybeans. And I will throw one last thing at you. The number two and number three, the number two and number three economies of the world, China and Japan, right now are both trying to stimulate their domestic economies by stimulating their domestic consumption. And I think when they stepped up and bought Smithfield, it was an eye-opener to the market in the medium term. And this is where I think the bins may have a place in our marketing plan after harvest. And it's great to be with you all today.
Well, I'm going to follow up on your question, okay? I think from a perspective, I know when you hear us talk about, you know, buying puts, doing those kinds of things, you think of us as being bearish. What we really are is talking about the same thing these guys were talking about. It's called revenue protection. And in a worst-case scenario, that's all you have to care about. And so I think that it isn't a matter of being bearish. I personally think that we can go up here next week, go higher, probably put in our time, take a short-term drop, and in harvest find our way back out again. You know, but it's a matter of everybody gets hung up on rallies. Well, it always comes down to where's it going to rally from? you know, when you come right down to it. And just because we talk about it, we're risk managers, so don't think of us as being bearish just because we're talking about that. I wanted to talk a little bit about South America and about the beans. I know Jerry started talking about it. Right now, when you look at the corn-bean ratio or the bean-corn ratio here in the U.S., we hit 2.8 on Friday. And, you know, that's an extremely high number. Normally, we would see 2.5 to 1. You'd start to see people selling beans and buying corn. Well, with the tightness we've got in the carryout, that's not the case this year. But I think there's some things that you need to know about South America right now. The Brazilian real has been depreciating in value against the U.S. dollar. All of their pricing is done in U.S. dollars. In other words, when they get paid based on U.S. dollars, but they get paid in their current currency. So the Brazilians are actually making more money selling beans right now than they were before. The ratio in Mato Grosso as of this week was 4 to 1. In other words, it says plant beans. It doesn't say plant corn. The ratio in Paraná was 3 to 1. Again, plant beans, don't plant corn. And that's what Jerry's talking about, a lot bigger acres down in South America. When it comes to corn itself down there, they've had 3 frosts now in southern Brazil. Totally, I mean, you just don't hear about it. Once in a blue moon do they ever have a frost. They've had 3 frosts in the last 6 weeks, which again says they're going to plant beans, not corn, because of the timing of the whole situation. So I can certainly agree what you need to do is take advantage of the rally that we have and then be focused on 2014 beans, because you know the trade's going to come in, and the minute we see an increase in South American production, you'll see a decrease in our price.
Another thing I'd like to say about pricing corn. I've had a lot of guys here in the last couple of weeks get a little bit excited about maybe pricing a few bushels of corn simply based upon what their yields look like. Guys that looked at it 2 weeks ago are looking at it differently today than what they looked at 2 weeks ago, first of all. That's something that we all need to think about. But second of all, I had a lot of guys tell me, well, if I go ahead and sell at 450 corn and then, you know, collect insurance, I'm going to come out in pretty good shape. And I agree with you, but how many of you guys know whether you're going to collect insurance or not? And I think a lot of us have just kind of made it a foregone conclusion that the market's going to tank in October. And you guys know as well as I do, if we all want it to tank in October because of our insurance, what's it going to do? It's probably not going to tank in October, right? I mean, how many of us wanted $8.50 for corn last year for our insurance price on our insured bushels? I know we did. We sold quite a bit of it, you know, above $7.50. We scaled into it. I kind of agree with what Jackie's saying, but I also think, you know, from the insurance standpoint, whatever you guys do, always try to learn. From last year, we can learn about how do we sell insured bushels when the market goes extremely high compared to our spring price. This spring, our price is $5.65, almost identical as last year. And what happened here in the last 3 weeks, we dipped under $4.50. And if you guys would look at that, how many of you guys have heard, you know, protect your insurance by buying calls or going long the board? Has anybody heard that? Surely somebody has. Well, guys that stepped in and bought sub 450, you know, I had a few guys that did that. Now, timing's always everything, all right? Sometimes you get lucky, sometimes you don't. But if you bought that at sub 450, what's the worst thing that's going to happen if it goes lower? If you lose on your futures, what are you doing on your insurance? You're picking up money on your insurance, so it's a true hedge. And if you call it a true hedge and treat it as a true hedge, you can do pretty good on that. Now, if that's something that you did and you bought into the market, you actually could have generated $100 an acre of income at this point if you liquidate. Now, if it's a true hedge, I'm going to tell you not to liquidate until you're doing whatever it is that you're trying to do comes to pass, which is your insurance. That's my last point. If you do too much of cash sales without knowing what your insurance is and without doing any risk management, it could really bite you this year. I would be really cautious as to put too many eggs in any basket.
I say, yeah, you know, adding it, you mentioning that South America came up again. This idea is what's going on in the soybean crop and where we're looking at. You know, the rally where we had $14, I can make a case for $15.50 soybeans. But I would very much kind of like, let's revisit what happened this year. There's too many producers behind the eight ball. Granted, you don't know what your production is now, whatever you sold, but ain't nobody I've spoken to has oversold their crop or their potential production. Yeah. He said, and Matt said less than half of what it would normally be. But go out, take a look at 2014, no beans. Would $12.25 work, you know? That's where they're at. That's where we put it, $12.25 for no. And then we're looking at, right now, this soybean market isn't going to go away. We're not going to be looking at $11 or $12 Novi soybeans anytime soon, and that's going to be incentive. And you know you're going to have pressure when you come into harvest and understanding. And this taking into consideration the world stocks usage ratio with corn and coarse grains, wheat, so on and so forth, they'll get traction. But for the time being, the South Americans can make their decisions off. You know, it's going to May 2014 is basically our November contract. That's what they're going to hedge off. So there you increase production, take a hard look at that soybean, 2014 soybean crop.
All right. Well, I'm going to make one correlated statement in relationship to this. Higher soybean prices that are encouraging South America right now, they're also... our current corn prices are not really encouraging them to plant their second crop, Safrinha corn, which is in that area of Mato Grosso, the furthest away from the port. Last year, as we remember, we were hearing it was $2 to get that soybean transported from Mato Grosso down to the ports. Well, that same $2 is the same feature as a part of their corn cost situation. I mean, yeah, none of us like $4.50 $5 corn, but when you put $2 more in their pocket to try to physically get money out of a $2.50 corn, and they're not making they've had good yields the last few years. I sense that that's a helpful thing for us on the corn's longer-term outlook. I do not want to say that this is going to change our outlook in the next 6 to 8 months here, because we're going to have a potentially a 1.5 or a 1.4 at the worst carryover stock, but it does give us some slight optimism that we're not having the world totally compete with us on a long-term basis. We got a chance for our corn exports to come back on a 2.14, maybe even 2.15 period of time, when this year, you know, we had $700 million all we got out the door, partly because we didn't have any more corn to sell. The other thing is the USDA has already put part of that back in with 1.2 million, but hopefully we need to have a 1.7, a 2 billion number again in our future. Hopefully, I think between China wanting more corn and Brazil maybe not planting as much because it's not profitable for them, hopefully that's what we have in a little longer-term optimism for corn. But it's going to be a struggle for the next 6 to 8 months. It's all yours, John.
I beg Todd to let me talk a little bit about land values, and he says after that I got to sit down and shut up and sit down, maybe not necessarily in that order. As a jumping-off point, we're going to make the assumption that land prices have doubled over the last 5-6 years. How many of you all think the land price trend is up? How many of you think it's sideways? How many of you think it's lower? I guess I'm kind of in the lower camp, but I don't know how far. Now, Jackie and I have an acquaintance who, by the time he was 35 years old, had forgotten more about the livestock marketing business than I will ever be able to hope to know in my lifetime. And he went out and he got him some data. And he backed all the way up to 1948. And what he did was he plotted the ratio of how many calves it took to buy a Ford pickup truck. And here's 1948 over here, here's 1990 over there, and he was chop, 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 chop. And his position was this chop, chop, chop up here, when it took more calves to buy a pickup truck, was driven by ethanol. And he's chopped a little more sideways since then. Now, that's what he sees. I'm not quite so sure I see that in his chart. But he also made another plot. And that was how many acres of corn it takes to buy a pickup truck. And starting here in 1948, chop, 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 chop. And the acres of corn that it takes to buy a pickup truck today, according to his chart, is the lowest it has been in the last 65 years. His conclusion is, we ought to be selling some of that ground. And as Lady Godiva said, when she got down off her horse, Todd, I have come to my close.
You see, my job's really hard, right? You know what I do? I'm head water boy. That's it. Give these folks a nice round of applause. They'll all be here for a while if you want to talk to them. Thank you so much for supporting the University of Illinois. Send your kids to us at the U of I. Send them somewhere for a college education. It is really, really important. Have a great afternoon. Thank you.